Good afternoon. House Labor and Commerce Committee will come to order at 3:19 p.m. on Monday, March 27th. Please remember, turn off your cell phones or turn them to silent or quiet or some other setting that doesn't make a lot of noise. And present in the committee, we've got Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Stutes, Representative Knopp, Representative Birch, Representative Josephson, Vice Chair Woola, myself, Chair Quito. We have a quorum to conduct business. We have a full committee. Let's recognize our support staff. As always, Caitlin Ellis, our LIO moderator, and Summers Cole, our LIO moderator. Caitlin Ellis, our recording secretary. Today, we've got three items on the agenda: governor's appointments to state boards and commissions, House Bill 170, Alaska Securities Act penalties and rules, and HB 103, optometry and optometrists. We have six individuals that we plan on hearing from. And actually, Representative Fansler, if you'd like to join us up at the table, just grab one of the extra chairs we have, and you're welcome to be here and ask questions as well. So what we're going to do is we've got the governor's appointments. Our committee has received 61 names, and we asked members of the committee to submit names of appointees they would like to speak with directly or that they had questions for. We received requests to hear from 9 individuals. Today, we have 6 of those individuals online with us, and we have 3 at a future meeting. So what I'd like to do for our process today is bring each one of the individuals forward, see if we have comments, questions, and then we will read a motion that will bring all 61 names forward and move them to the House floor. So first I would like to ask Jonathan Vito, Mr. Vito, if you're available, go ahead and place your name on the record for us.
Hi, this is Jonathan Vito.
Thank you, Mr. Vito. Board of Chiropractic Examiners, and we have some questions for Mr. Vito. Representative Josephson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Vito, I think this will be fast. I suspect you have you have other things to do, and so I'll be fast. But in our review of the curriculum vitae, there are some people who, and I suspect this was just an oversight or something like that, but in the conflict of interest section, when asked about potential financial conflicts, you indicated there could be some, but didn't explain them. And I assume, I'll give you a chance to explain any that you perceive might be there.
I don't understand what the question was.
Sure. So you've asked to be on the chiropractic board.
Yes.
And you've indicated that you or a family member could be conflicted based on some sort of financial impact to the family, and then indicated, when asked to explain that financial benefit, you didn't indicate any. And so I just had that.
Probably what I meant was, in regards to, doing peer action, like reprimanding, okay, or the licensing, because I'm part owner of Better Health, and we have a bunch of different offices. So the only time I could see having a conflict of interest would be, if it was up to me, to give someone a license and they were going to come work for me or something.
Okay. And you would be through the chair.
Follow up.
In a meeting of the board, you would be comfortable declaring that conflict, I assume.
Yes, I have no problem.
Okay, I have no other questions for Dr. Vito.
Okay, any other questions for Dr. Vito? Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Vito, I just wanted to see if you could give us just a little quick synopsis of how you think the chiropractic examiners board works and what you feel you bring to the table to help this particular board.
I believe they go through and they help structure Alaska statutes and what the chiropractors can and cannot do in the state. I hope to bring kind of like a newer, younger blood to the board, and not saying that they're all old, but new ways of thinking, more integration into chiropractic clinics, also switching up, bring us more to a electronic test taking for new people that want to come up here to become chiropractors in the state, where they could take the test online, and then when we do have the board meetings, do their meeting with the board then and not have to wait every 3 months to be able to get a license.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vito. I don't see any further questions. Thank you for taking the time to be able to call in today, and appreciate your interest in serving on the chiropractic board.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Okay, next up we have Robert Klein. Mr. Klein, if you can place your name on the record, and we'll see what questions we have for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Robert Klein.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. And questions? Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair for Mr. Klein. Mr. Klein, I just really have one question for you. In the conflict of interest section, and again, this may have just been an oversight or distraction or something, but you were asked whether you would produce disclosures relating to your financial data, and you said no. And you were asked whether there could be any family conflict, and you said no, which could be the correct answer. But I guess I want to make sure. Are you declining to provide financial data as required by law?
Through the chair. No, as a matter of fact, I just recently filled out my APAC, which gave the financial information required. And as far as conflicts, I am or will be one of the industry members on the board. I've served on the board for a number of years, and whenever there is a conflict, I have no hesitancy in declaring.
Okay, just a follow-up?
A follow-up.
So, Mr. Klein, did you say that you did provide to some entity your financial data?
That's APAC, which is the required financial reporting each year.
Okay.
And I've complied.
All right. Thank you. Nothing more, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Stutz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair. Hi, Bob. It's Louise Stutz. And I'm curious, are you currently involved in the rewrite of Title IV?
Thank you, Representative Stutz. Through the chair. I've been on the board for a number of years, and that process has been going on since May of 2012. As you know, we last year brought forth SB 165 with a portion of it, but this year, thanks to Senator Michiki, we are bringing forth SB 76. Hopefully that's the end of a long road to rewrite Title IV. And yes, I have been very, very involved in it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you. Any other member questions? Representative Fensler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Mr. Klein, could you just speak a little bit to your views on what the balance of power is between, say, the ABC board and municipal governments in making determinations?
The way that Title IV is currently structured, it gives municipalities a chance to comment on any license that comes before them, whether it's new or renewal, and to protest if they object to a license. And the ABC can't override that protest unless we find it to be arbitrary, capricious, and unreasonable. So municipalities have a tremendous say in what goes on in their locations.
Follow up.
Follow up, if I may, through the chair, Mr. Klein. Can you speak a little more maybe to the idea of what arbitrary, capricious, and unreasonable is in your mind?
Through the chair, arbitrary, capricious, and unreasonable usually means that either there's been a terrible misinterpretation of Title IV or some special interest has been has exerted an amount of influence on the municipality's decision that really is not fair or logical. But for the most part, if there is an objection from the municipality, it carries through. We support it.
Follow up, if I may, Mr. Chair. Can you speak to your experiences within rural Alaska and perhaps any developments that you've been following in communities like Bethel and Ammonic that are kind of transitioning to new phases with alcohol in their communities?
We have been, I've served on the board for quite a number of years, and we've been very involved in rural communities through local option. And through our travels, you know, we have to meet once in every judicial district once a year. And so we do get into the rural areas and do encourage their representatives to come forward. We also use it as an education tool. For example, the last visit, or actually it was two visits ago to Nome, we met with members of the assembly to educate them on the rights and the responsibilities that they have with respect to licenses.
Follow up regarding that, do you feel that the possible changes that are coming forward through Title IV, that there may be some changes that could affect rural communities or communities that are in trying to decide if they want to be damp or dry or wet?
Through the chair, interesting question. Through the Title IV work, we discovered that we worked on mostly enforcement, shoring up troopers and worried about alcohol consumption in rural areas. What we found when marijuana was processing their regulations was there are some tweaks that are necessary to the entire way in which localities select and put into effect local option. And our next phase of Title IV will address some of those. Current Title IV is mainly concerned with enforcement.
And one final follow-up, if I may, through the chair. Thank you for that. Could you perhaps also speak to perhaps how Title IV may anticipate problems that I know we see in my region, particularly when one community has decided to go wet, it makes the enforcement of being dry in local villages more difficult. Could you tell me any tools that could perhaps be put in place or to help communities that wish to be dry truly be dry?
You've described one of the real conundrums that that occurs in the rural area. When you get a village or a municipality that decides to go wet and the surrounding areas are dry, what we tried to do with the current version of Title IV is to shore up enforcement and to improve the amount of data collection. But the real issues are with the villagers, how they teach and train people to stay out of the adjacent areas where alcohol is readily available. In addition, when a license like that comes before the ABC, we see whatever steps can be taken and make sure that the group that's going wet understands their responsibility to the surrounding communities. we're gaining a good bit of traction, and Bethel is a good example.
Hello?
I think I'm okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wohl?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Klein, I have a few questions about the board, I guess. The last year, there was a bill that passed about the makeup of the board. Do you think the board, the current makeup, is functioning well? I mean, in other words, I guess in specific, I look at, of course, I'm also in the industry, so industry representation has come up. So, do you feel the industry is appropriately represented?
I do. That model, through the chair, that model has existed since the 80s and appears to be working well. One of the things that we did last year with 165 was created a permanent chair for public safety. But in the history of the board, most governors have been appointing at least one member who has an affiliation with public safety. So that won't be a radical change. I think the size of the board of five works extremely well, and the fact that we have two industry representatives, I think, works well as an addition to that.
Hello.
I guess with five people, two industries seems about all you could do. I look at the industry that's changed a little bit lately. I mean, you're in the distillery business. There's a growing brewery business right now that probably wasn't the case when the board was formed for either of those categories. Then you have distribution, and then you have the various sort of beer and wine license holders and beverage dispensary license holders. Currently, none of those groups are represented, and I know there is some rotation. However, your seat's been pretty solid, I think, for a while. So I'm just... with all the new industries that's come along, actually, in the last, say, 20 years, you feel there should be more representation for those other aspects of the industry?
Well, hopefully, you know, I also serve as a board member at CHAR, and we have, in fact, on our board several manufacturers as well as all aspects of retail. I think we do have good lines of communication with all aspects of it. My sordid past, you know, I was spent a lot of time in retail, right. Spent time consulting with wholesalers, and now I'm running a distillery. So I've touched it all, and I really think that the industry has good representation on the board.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. This is Representative Keto, and I do have just got a baby more of a comment, but a question or something for you to think about as you look at your future service on the Alcohol Beverage Control Board, and that's related to what Representative Fansler was talking about, and that is I know that the current Title IV rewrite is dealing with enforcement. We have a geographic issue that makes it very challenging to try and enforce some components of law in some of the smaller or more remote communities. And I do think it's really important where we've got communities that are easily accessible to each other that we have adequate tools in place to make sure that communities that do want to stay dry have that ability without a flood of product coming in from an adjacent community that might not be dry. And so as you're looking at enforcement or as you're looking at possible statutory changes, with your expertise in the industry, with the other members of the board's expertise in their areas, I think it will be important to try and figure out how we can help support some of these communities that really do want to try and protect their citizens. And instead of drawing the line around the community that's going wet, can we try and figure out a way that we can enable some of these smaller communities to have tools that can help protect them from alcohol coming into their communities? So not as much a question, but something for you to contemplate as you're looking at your service.
Thank you, Representative Keto. It's well taken.
Okay, thank you, and thank you for your willingness to serve on the board or continue to serve on the board, and appreciate your taking the time to call in. So thank you, Mr. Klein.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Okay, and next up we have Lee Holen. Mr. Holen, if you're available, you can put your name on the record, and we can ask a few questions.
Yes, Lee Holen.
Thank you, Ms. Holen. So, questions?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Ms. Holen, Andy Josephson here. I just have a quick question for you. You, in your, and I suspect it's just a matter of moving through the application quickly, but in your application you said that you would give full disclosure of personal financial data and also declared that there could theoretically be a conflict of interest in your appointment if you serve on the Alaska Labor Relations Agency. And then it asked to explain what that potential financial benefit would be, and you said it was not applicable. Can you just describe that just a little bit?
Well, I think I was concerned about a potential conflict of interest if, you know, by any chance a client of mine would come before the board. I don't really see any financial conflict because I wouldn't hear a matter that involves someone with whom I received financial benefits.
Okay. I guess that's all I had. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Holen? Thank you, Ms. Holen, for taking the time to call in, and do appreciate your interest and desire to participate on the Board of Labor Relations, and thank you for allowing us to ask you a few questions.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next, we have Suzanne Dutson. Ms. Dutson, can you place your name on the record?
My name is Suzanne Dutson.
Thank you, Ms. Dutson, and Representative Josephson.
Yes, through the chair, Ms. Dutson, my name is Andy Josephson, and I just really have one question. Often these CVs reflect that the governor wisely chose people with a strong background, and that's certainly true in your case as well. However, in the conflict of interest section, it says that you're unwilling. I don't know if you meant it this deliberately, but it says that when asked, would you disclose your personal financial data, you said no. And when asked about potential financial conflicts, you said no. But the way it's asked, well, I suppose that answer seems plausible to me. You said that there couldn't be any financial conflict. But my question is, are you willing to disclose your personal financial data as required?
Oh, absolutely. I think I misunderstood the question in that I would make that information, you know, public in my seat. And no, I would not do that. But certainly if you want to look at any of my financial data, you're more than welcome. It's a short look.
Okay. Thank you. That's all I had. I just, in order to do due diligence, I need to make sure that someone understands that that's a current responsibility. Thank you.
Sure, that's not a problem, and I apologize for the misunderstanding on the question.
Not a problem.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Dutson. Any other questions for Ms. Dutson? If not, thank you for taking the time to call in, and thank you for your interest in serving on the Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associate Examiner. So thank you for calling in. And we also have Dr. Michael Moriarty, Board of Dental Examiners. Mr. Moriarty, can you place your name on the record for us, and we will have a question for you?
Could you repeat that again? My line was broken up there.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just asking you to place your name on the record, and then we will have a question for you.
Oh, okay. Great. My name is Michael P. Moriarty. I am a dentist in Seward, Alaska.
Thank you, Mr. Moriarty. And questions? I am actually not seeing any questions, so... All right. Well, it doesn't look like we have anyone here that has questions right now. I do appreciate you taking the time to call in.
You bet. Well, thank you for the time.
Appreciate your interest
and,
in
have a great
the
day.
Board of Dental Examiners. Thank you, Dr. Moriarty.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Okay. We have one other person on our list, but we don't have him online at the time, Mr. James Henderson. We will try and reach him and bring his name forward perhaps at our next meeting. What I do think we will do now is go ahead and move the names that we do have. So Representative Wool, actually, before we get to that point, just so everyone knows that when we move this report forward, there is no obligation to vote for these individuals when they come to the floor. All it says is we are taking these names. We haven't found anything of concern, and we're moving them to the floor. That doesn't obligate you to vote any particular way once that gets to the floor. So,
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, sir. What Representative Josephson had brought forward in his questioning, will that be then changed in the CV for these particular candidates? If not, they should be, just so it sets the record straight.
Representative Sullivan Leonard, I believe that the applications will actually be modified from what we submit to the speaker. So what we do have is the question that was asked on the record that becomes part of the record that moves forward, and it will be available for people that are looking in the future.
Very good. Thank you, sir.
Okay. And with that, Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that the list of appointees reviewed by this committee will be forwarded to a joint session of the legislature for confirmation.
Okay. Thank you. And I will object. What we do have to do is actually read through each one of the appointees. And so I will be doing that. We have Alaska State Board of Public Accountancy, Wayne Hogue from Kotzebue, Donovan Rulian II from Anchorage, Maria Beltrami from Anchorage, Alcohol Beverage Control Board, Robert Klein from Anchorage, State Board of Registration for Architects and Land Surveyors, Jeffrey Kuntz, Anchorage, Elizabeth Johnson, Fairbanks, John Kerr, Anchorage, Richard Jones, Juneau, Board of Barbers and Hairdressers, Michelle McMullen, Anchorage, Jennifer Lombardo, Anchorage, Terry and Shell, Big Lake, Board of Chiropractic Examiners, Jonathan Vito, Anchorage, Brian Larson, Soldotna, Board of Dental Examiners, Michael Moriarty, Seward, Stephen Scheller, Fairbanks, Gail Walden, Wasilla, Alaska Labor Relations Agency, Elizabeth Pierce, Anchorage, Lee Holen, Anchorage, Marijuana Control Board, Nicholas Miller, Anchorage, Peter Milnick, Soldotna, Mark Springer, Bethel, Board of Marine Pilots, Ronald Ward II, Anchorage, Board of Marital and Family Therapy, Nicole Jenkins Palmer, Karen Cunningham, Anchorage, Board of Massage Therapists, Tracy Gilmore, Juneau, Jill Motz, Wasilla, Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives, Kathy Roberts, Anchorage, Dana Brown, Fairbanks. Board of Nursing, Joseph LaFour, Ketchikan. I'll address that in a minute. So Joseph LaFour, Ketchikan. Occupational Safety and Health Review Board, Thomas Trosvig, Kodiak. Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, Daniel Seamount, Anchorage. Board of Examiners and Optometry, Eric Christensen, Ketchikan. Board of Pharmacy, James Henderson, Soldotna, Terry Giesel, Eagle River, Lena Bell, Anchorage. State Physical Occupational and Occupational Therapy Board, Jennifer Carlson, Fairbanks, Rebecca Bingham, Anchorage. Board of Professional Counselor, Eleanor Vinson, Juneau, Ann Brainerd, Marco, Fairbanks, Deborah Hamilton, Soldotna. Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associate Examiners, Deborah Gideon, Juneau, Anchorage, Suzanne Dudson, Juneau. Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers, Renee Pizchik, Fairbanks. Real Estate Commission, Eric Bushnell, Wasilla, Guy Mickel, Boards Cove, Dana Pruse, Fairbanks. Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission, Deirdre Ford, Anchorage. Stephanie Hangendorn, Anchorage. Alaska Workers' Compensation Board, Brett Stubbs, Anchorage. Linda Murphy, Soldotna, Donna Phillips, Girdwood, Aaron Pilkett, Anchorage. Lake Williams, Fairbanks, Salatogi, Letuiigasenoa. I apologize. I don't have the pronunciation. That's the spelling of his name. Fairbanks, Rick Traney, Anchorage, Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation Board of Directors. David Wright, Anchorage, Hugh Short, Girdwood, Warren Christian, North Pole. Oh, and I do need to retract James Henderson because we still have yet to hear from him. So he was
Board of Pharmacy.
So that list of names that I read minus James Henderson, and the reason we have a few names that we have not read is there's still another meeting that we have that we're going to hear from a few people. So that list of names minus James Henderson, we will be moving forward. And with that, what I'll do is remove my objection and we will pass the paperwork around to sign the signature page. I'll take a brief at ease while we go through that process. Thank you. Okay. Thank you. We are back on the record in House Labor and Commerce, Monday, March 27th, and we now have House Bill 170. So let's see. We have public testimony open, and I do only have people signed up for questions. Is there anyone in the room that would like to provide public testimony on House Bill 170? I'm not seeing anyone. We do have not my staff here right now. But we have Kevin Anselm, Division of Banking Securities, available for questions. Christy Naylor, Division of Banking Securities. Renee Wardlaw, Assistant Attorney General. And Deb Etheridge with Health and Social Services. Do we have any questions for any of those individuals? I'm not seeing any questions. So I will close public testimony. Any committee comments about House Bill 170? I see no committee comments. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move HB 170 version 30-LS0333/J be passed from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
So any objection to the motion as stated? No objections. House Bill 170 passes. We'll take a brief at ease while we sign our paperwork. Thank you. We are back on the record, House Labor and Commerce. It is now 3:56 p.m. Last bill for us today is House Bill 103. We intend to hear this bill, start public testimony, and then we will set it aside for a future meeting. If we can have the bill sponsor, Representative Sponholz, come forward. Place your name and affiliation on the record and begin your testimony, and as well as your staff, Ms. Nesbitt.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and Committee. I'm Representative Ivy Sponholz. I represent District 16 in East Anchorage, and today we're presenting House Bill 130, which gives authority to the board.
103.
Oh, my goodness gracious. Thank you. A little dyslexia. 103. Which gives authority to the Board of Optometry to regulate the practice of optometry, much as is done by doctors, midwives, chiropractors, dentists, and other healthcare professionals throughout the state of Alaska. It ensures that the Board of Optometry have the opportunity to update their both current and continuing education standards and the scope of practice based on what is best practiced and evidence available. The bill will not allow optometrists to provide services outside of their scope of practice, like performing complicated surgeries. What it will allow is for the Board of Optometrists to utilize the regulatory process to manage themselves, just as doctors, nurses, midwives, chiropractors, and nurses do. The bill allows a robust regulatory process, which a Department of Law representative will describe in detail later, to work. This regulatory process is public and transparent, ensuring that any new regulations will be fully vetted by the board, the public, and the Department of Law. In fact, it's so robust that the board has developed higher continuing education standards for themselves in regulation than we as a legislative body have in statute. It is my hope that this bill will get the legislature out of the business of managing optometrists so we can focus our efforts and energies on issues which do require our attention. And then my aide, Bernice Nesbitt, will take us through a sectional of the bill.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Bernice Nesbitt, and I will be going over the sections with you of the CS of HB 103. And for the record, we're also looking at version J of the CS for HB 103. So Section 1 focuses on the regulations within the Board of Optometry, which will give them the ability to develop uniform standards of practice for optometry and prescribe pharmaceuticals for the treatment of the eye disease. The most significant change in Section 1 is that the language regarding ophthalmic surgery and non-invasive procedures have been removed. And in Section 2, as the bill stands now, it has been amended to state that number 4, if you look at line 3, page 2, number 4, publish advisory opinions regarding standards of the practice of optometry as provided under this chapter. The sponsor of the bill would like to add an amendment to tighten up the language here and we will hopefully introduce that on Wednesday. I'd also like to draw your attention to line 13 of page 1, where it says Section 11, Chapter 25, SLA. This is referring to the Medicaid reform bill that was passed in 2016, and I'll be referring to that again in Section 7, so just keep that in mind. And then again on page 2, line 5, it's referring to AS 17.30.200O. That's also referring to the Medicaid reform bill. In Section 3, this states that a licensee shall submit to the board evidence that they have completed their continuing education hours during the preceding licensing period. Section 4, subsection A, has been repealed, and the new language is updated to allow licensees to prescribe and use pharmaceuticals in the practice of optometry. Section 5 is a new section that adds a limitation on practice for a licensee of optometry, and that their services or procedures that a licensee is able to perform need to be within their scope of education, training, and experience. Section 6, subsection 3 is repealed, and the new language updates the definition of optometry. And then Section 7 refers back to Section 2 and its effective date of July 17th, 2017. And that completes the end of the sectional analysis. If you have any questions regarding the bill, I'd be happy to take any questions. Also note that Dr. Matheson and Dr. Barney are in the room to answer questions. And Harriet Milks, who's the Assistant Attorney General, is in the room to answer any other questions that you have.
Thank you. Any questions from the bill sponsor, Representative Justice?
Actually, for Ms. Milks. Can I ask the bill sponsor?
So maybe before we get to that, I think Representative Wohl has a question for the bill sponsor. So Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, you mentioned in Section, I think it was Section 1, mm-hmm. You removed some language that talked about procedures or, mm-hmm. Can you go over that and explain it? Since it's omitted, I don't know what it is.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Wohl, the initial version of this bill had stated in Section 1 that optometrists are not allowed to, or it had language stating ophthalmic surgery, and so that language is taken out of that bill completely.
To follow up, Representative Wohl, through the chair, this is Representative Sponholz for the record. We took that language out because there's a challenge in accurately defining ophthalmic surgery in a way that made the statute clear. Unfortunately, to lay people, the word surgery has sort of very specific connotations, but in the practice of healthcare, it's a broadly used term, and a few weeks ago I had a small foreign body removed from my left eye, and that meets the definition of surgery, of ophthalmic surgery by some definitions. And so rather than try to split that hair so tightly in statute, which seemed like a very, very difficult thing to do, we felt that it was better to leave that sort of not defined in statute and instead have the authority for developing uniform standards of practice around optometry stay with the board. This does not mean that the Board of Optometry will have the authority to allow for surgeries that are outside of their scope of practice. It simply means that they will be allowed to do small minor surgeries that are technically within their scope of practice, but not do things which are outside of their scope of practice. So it was a matter of trying to find the right language to meet the legal criteria that we have that was durable and, you know, would still be relevant after a few years. And I think a good example of the lack of durability of the previous statute is on page 2. You'll see in Section 3, there's a whole section here that we removed which describes very specific time frame in which certain kinds of continuing education needs to take place. and we removed most of that language because what we found, in fact, was that the board had more rigorous education, continuing education standards than were required there. And what we'd like for them to do is, as a board, have the authority to regulate themselves as rigorously as they'd like without having to take it back to the legislature every time they want to make a minor change in their practice.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Justin.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Spunholz, who ultimately in the final analysis would decide whether an optometrist's regulation in terms of scope of practice mm-hmm. was consistent with their background education and training? I mean, who in the final analysis, who would decide that?
It would be both a combination, I believe, of the Board of Optometry and the Department of Law.
Okay. Thanks.
Representative Knopp.
Would you touch on, I missed the proposed amendment, what section, what language on?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Knopp. The language that we are, or the sponsor is intending to change, if you look at page 2, line 6, where it says, publish advisory opinions regarding standards for the practice of optometry as provided under this chapter, we would like to change that language to read, as it says in the statutes for the Board of Nursing, and I will just read from section 08.68.100 for you to reference later if you'd like to look at this, no, but it's no. Number 9, okay. And it says, publish advisory opinions regarding whether nursing practice procedures, which will say ophthalmic practice procedures, or policies comply with acceptable standards of ophthalmic practice as defined under this chapter.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. That's a quick, brief comment.
Go ahead, Representative. Oh.
So, for the sponsor of the bill, you know, I read it time and time again. I looked at all the letters of support and the letters of opposition, mm-hmm. And I think it's a good bill, and I'm glad you. But what I like about it is how well you covered the sectional analysis and what it did, and you covered every concern I had about operating within the limits of their training, mm-hmm. the continuing education requirements, and so I think it's a great bill, and I'm glad to support it. And also, on just note for the record, you know, and in my experiences and other people I know and a member of the other body has got most eye problems are found by optometrists, you know, and then the ophthalmologists get into advanced procedures for correction after the fact. But I think optometrists do a great job in all my experiences and some of the experience I've heard about. So I'm just really glad to see the bill. I'm a big supporter of it. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, I appreciate your remarks. We worked very hard to make sure that this bill was very tight, and I think our amendment that we'll have on Wednesday will tighten it even further. We want to make sure that we're not giving any, we're giving any inclination that it's our intention to broaden the scope of practice of optometrists beyond that for which they're properly trained. So.
Thank you, and I do believe we have a question for Ms. Milks. So thank you, Representative Spanholtz and Ms. Nisbet. Ms. Milks, if you can place your name and affiliation on the record, and I think Representative Josephson then had a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let's wait.
Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Harriet Milks. I'm with the Department of Law, and I represent a number of healthcare boards and commissions, including the Board of Optometry.
Thank you, Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Milks, I listened to the first presentation in the prior committee, and you were asked about what you do, and you talked about the Administrative Procedure Act, and my question isn't about that, but you said something about how your office would not intervene on policy or comment on how the board regulates itself, and I'm just wondering if is there a time when the Department of Law would step in and say, you optometrists want to do X and you don't have the training to do X? I mean, would the Department of Law have that authority, or does it play that role?
Thank you, Representative Josephson. Through the chair, absolutely. That is our role. And the way we do that is we look very carefully at the scope of the statutory authority that you would give the board. And that's our starting place. And from there, we advise the board as to whether a proposed regulation is outside the scope of that statutory authority. So for sure, and it does happen, the Department of Law has advised boards that a proposed regulation is beyond the scope of their statutory authority.
A follow-up. Through the chair, Ms. Milks, the concern of the ophthalmologist is that the way the bill is written, that optometrists could define what treatment means, and there are other concerns that ophthalmologists have, but that word is troublesome to them. So how, if they said, that is, if it, the optometry board, said, we want to practice in this area and here's the regulation that does it, and it's a type of treatment, would you have the power to say what? I mean, what could you do? If they said, we think this is proper treatment within our scope, could you say, I, Ms. Milks, don't agree? Or how would that work?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, it can sometimes be a delicate balance, for sure. We in the Department of Law don't make judgments, and we don't substitute our vision of whatever the policy should be for the optometrist, but we would look at the language of the statute, and we would look at where the word treatment occurs. We would look at the whole statute to see if there is any indication that treatment, as the legislature envisioned it, would encompass whatever it was that the board was envisioning, including as treatment. We would also take into consideration the whatever public comment came in, because anything that the board does to define something like treatment would have to be affected through regulation, and that's a public process. So the board would draft a regulation, would go out for public comment. 30 or more days later, the public comment would come in. That would be very important in informing us and informing the board as to the permissible scope of their definition of treatment.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for being here. In this capacity, we talk a lot about rural Alaska, and I think in the context of our debate and discussion here, we've talked about some areas and communities of the state that are maybe underserved is not a fair characterization, but you know, just because it's a small community, there's you know, they kind of rely on a single person, whether it's veterinarians, you know, how often does a vet show up, or it's a physician. I know dentists, we had a big royal kerfluffle over, you know, what, you know, whether, you know, if somebody's got their heads exploding because they've got an abscess tooth, whether somebody that's not a dentist in a rural community can kind of step in and kind of help out. One question that I had was, where is that Good Samaritan law? And I know, you know, so if somebody steps in to help out, you know, to boil water if you're having a baby, right, or whatever they do when you have a baby. But, you know, if you step in to help out, how does that work from a legal standpoint? If you're in a community, you're an optometrist, but somebody's got a fish hook in their eye. You know, how does it work when somebody that's not, you know, a bona fide, you know, ophthalmologist or a dentist or a veterinarian kind of steps in to help out in an underserved community? How does that work?
Representative Birch, I don't know the answer to that right now. I'd be happy to look into it and get back to you. It's an interesting question, certainly. In the case of the optometrist, they do have statutory authority for removing fish hooks.
Okay.
How the Good Samaritan law works with them or veterinarians, yeah. I'm sorry I can't tell you right now, but if you'd like me to look into it, I'd be happy.
I would, through the chair, I'd be interested in that, just because it comes up frequently when we talk about, you know, smaller communities that many of us have had a lot of experience in, where you just have, you know, a few hundred people maybe, or maybe you just don't have the depth of experience there, and I was just curious as to how much engagement someone could have in that arena. But thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you to the chair. A question just came to mind, and I hope you don't mind me asking you. I've had the chance to talk to you before in previous committees, so I appreciate your input here. Are you aware of any court cases where there has been a challenge between an optometrist and their prescribed duties on a patient versus an ophthalmologist? Any court cases challenging that?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, I'm not. It doesn't mean there aren't any. I'm just not familiar with them.
Okay. Thank you. And I think Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. sort of follow up on Representative Josephson's question about treatment and definition of treatment, and Representative Sponholz mentioned the definition of the word surgery and that they're working on that. And I guess from the Department of Law perspective, are these definitions that would need to be defined in statute? When Representative Sponholz said removing of a foreign body from the eye could constitute surgery, I guess that makes a lot of layman surgeons, I mean, by that definition. So, I mean, if you remove something from someone's eye or something like that. So, I mean, at what point do you use, I mean, how are these terms defined for you, and do you need direction specifically from statute for, say, a word like surgery?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, that's an interesting question, and we look to a couple of different sources to define, to understand definitions of words like surgery. First and foremost, we look at the statute and what the legislature intended. Then we look at the board, because the board are they're the individuals who are appointed by the governor to regulate that particular profession. They're the source of the expertise. So surgery, for example, for an optometrist might be something quite different than for a dermatologist or for a heart surgeon, certainly. So we look to the board, and the board ultimately looks to the public to for notice and comment if it defines surgery by regulation. So what we don't do is make it up.
Thank you. Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So following up on Representative Wool's question, I've seen a lot of family doctors, general practitioners remove a lot of objects from eyes. So in your opinion, do you think an optometrist would be equally qualified to do what they do, since they do not specialize in eye treatment? Do you have an opinion or a thought on that?
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, no, I don't.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, and I believe Representative Sponholz might have an answer to that question.
What I have, Mr. Chair, is a clarification. This is for the record. This is Representative Sponholz again, a clarification. I mentioned the example about the removal of a foreign body as a way of illustrating how difficult it is to define the word surgery or what surgery means. I would like to clarify that it is in section 8.72.273 of the statute. It is actually, we do give optometrists explicit authority to remove foreign bodies. A licensee may remove superficial foreign bodies from the eye and its appendages. This section is not intended to permit a licensee to perform invasive surgery. I just want to get that on the record before we go too far down this bunny hole. I may have sort of muddied the waters by putting that example forward. I wanted to illustrate how difficult it is to define the word surgery, because surgery, as Assistant Attorney General Milks mentioned, surgery means many different things.
Thank you.
To clear.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair for Ms. Milks, and this may be beyond what you hired on to do as an AAG, but I guess one of my concerns is that the ongoing dispute between these two professions will just shift to the board. That there are probably some practices, for example, I've seen the Washington state law, where certain types of, I guess I'll use the word surgery for lack of a different term, are not precluded, and everything else is. And I'm just wondering if the net result is that ophthalmologists would be, if this bill became law, would need to go or have someone they trust to go to every board hearing and sort of offer some evidence and input about a proposed regulation that would expand the scope of practice. And if this doesn't just shift that debate to the board. Can you comment on that?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, if I understand your question, it perhaps it would be helpful to know that, in fact, the Department of Law does provide legal advice to the board at every meeting, every public meeting, if it requests an attorney to be present. In between meetings, we're available to answer questions for the board on administrative and governance issues. Beyond that, no, I don't have any specific, I certainly can't predict what ultimately will happen between the two professions that you just mentioned. That's not something that, that the Department of Law does.
Follow up.
Through the chair, I guess what I'm saying, though, is, and again, it may be beyond the role of the Department of Law to comment or intervene. The previous bill suggested a real interest in doing surgery from the optometry profession, the previous version of the bill. And so at some point there's going to have to be a day of reckoning, it seems like, where some surgeries will be allowed and some won't. And I'm just wondering if this bill does anything to resolve that, or if that's just for a later day.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I think I will look to the bill sponsor to answer that question. That's not something that I can answer.
Okay. Thanks. Any other questions for Ms. Milks? Thank you, Ms. Milks. I think what I'm going to do now is we've got about 40 minutes left, and we have not an excessive amount of people that are wanting to testify on the bill, so I'm going to go ahead and open up public testimony and first bring forward Dr. Paul Barney with the Board of Optometry, and if you can place your name and affiliation on the record and provide your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keto and fellow committee members. My name is Paul Barney. I'm an optometrist, and I'm the current chair of the Alaska Board of Examiners in Optometry. I'm also a past president of the Alaska Optometric Association, and I'm here today in support of HB 103. A little bit about myself. For the past 17 years, I've practiced in Anchorage, where I'm the center director of the Pacific Cataract and Laser Institute. Pacific Cataract and Laser Institute, also known as PCLI, is a referral center limited to medical and surgical eye care. I practice with an ophthalmologist and a certified registered nurse anesthetist. Our approach to eye care is to work as a team and optimize each practitioner's education and skills. I bring up my mode of practice with other eye care professionals because by practicing to our fullest potential, we're able to provide quality, more affordable surgical eye care for Alaskans. In fact, we are the largest provider of cataract care in the state of Alaska. I support HB 103 because it will allow the Board of Optometry to regulate the details of the practice of optometry. This is how advanced practice nurses, dentists, and medical doctors are regulated in Alaska. With that said, this legislation will not set a new precedence in healthcare and will not be a risk to Alaskans, since this is already the way other health care providers are regulated in Alaska. HB 103 will give optometrists better opportunity to practice at the highest level of their education by allowing the Board of Optometry to write regulations that are commensurate with educational advances that occur with new technology. The current optometry statute was written over 40 years ago and requires optometry to pursue a statute change whenever there are advances in education and technology. As you know, statute changes are costly and time-consuming. Like other professional regulatory boards, the Board of Optometry cannot promulgate regulations for practices or procedures that are beyond the education of optometrists. The Board of Optometry is overseen by the Alaska Department of Law, just like other healthcare boards, And the Alaska Department of Law would ensure that the Board of Optometry's regulations were within the scope of optometric education. Other safeguards are our medical legal system and insurance system. Any healthcare provider who provides care outside of their education is subject to disciplinary action by their respective board, as well as serious medical legal ramifications. Additionally, insurance carriers do not pay providers for care that they provide outside their scope of education. As a result, there's no incentive for any healthcare provider to provide care outside of their education, and there are very serious consequences, both financially and to their licensure, to practitioners who do provide care outside of their education. As chair of the Alaska Board of Optometry, I can assure you that the primary concern of the board is the safety of the public. In the 6 years that I've served on the board, we've had no complaints from the public that were serious enough to even consider disciplinary action. Optometrists in general are conservative and cautious practitioners, and the passage of HB 103 would not change their conservative nature. HB 103 would be good for the state of Alaska. The bill puts the regulatory details regarding the practice of optometry in the authority of the Alaska Board of Optometry. These changes are important to allow the profession and practice of optometry to incorporate new technologies and advances in eye care as they occur. Optometry provides approximately 70% of the eye care in the U.S., and in rural areas, especially in Alaska, they often are the only eye care provider in the community. The citizens of Alaska deserve to be served by a profession that is allowed to stay current with advances in education and new technologies, and I respectfully urge you to support HB 103. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Barney. Any questions? Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your testimony, and I too have been studying this pretty hard here over the last month or so that we've been chewing on this. One question I had relates to how do you do a handoff from an optometrist to an ophthalmologist? I assume that happens on a fairly regular basis where you, you know, in any sort of a medical environment where you say, hey, you know, we got to bring in somebody else. But I just was curious through the chairman as to how that actually transitions and works. Thank you.
Representative Birch, through the chair. In real life, optometry and ophthalmology work very well together. We seem to battle legislatively, but in real life, we work very well together. And that's done simply by having a good understanding of what everyone's potential is. Ophthalmologists and optometrists know what each is capable of and what the statute authority is. So that really is how that's done.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you, Dr. Barney.
Thank you.
Also in the room, we have Dr. Jill Matheson. Dr. Matheson, you want to come forward and place your name and affiliation on the record and provide your testimony?
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Dr. Jill Gearing Matheson, and I am a practicing doctor of optometry here in Juneau, and I'm a former chair of the optometry board right before Paul. Dr. Barney, sorry. Over the last 25 years, I have testified numerous times before this committee and many other legislative committees in support of changes to the Alaska optometry statute. And these have been successful over the years. This is due to the level of trust that the legislators have given optometrists in spite of rhetoric saying that we were going to harm people. Now I come before you not to argue safety or yet the efficacy of treatment options that need to be in statute, but to ask for your support for House Bill 103, which gives the Optometry Board the authority to regulate optometrists. Just as the people of Alaska elect all of you to represent them honestly, safely, and responsibly, the members of the state boards and commissions are appointed and confirmed by the legislature to do the same under their various areas of expertise. The days of the medical boards being the holy grail of overseeing every health profession are long gone. Alaska chose to set up separate boards for each profession because each profession is unique, and Alaska saw that the oversight for those professions needed to be handled by those members. So the people of Alaska, through the legislature, have approved statutes that are very broad to many of the other health boards. And these boards are now able to autonomously manage their respective professions in an honest, safe, and responsible manner. The optometry statute, on the other hand, is currently too complicated and restrictive. All House Bill 103 does is allow the State Board of Examiners in Optometry to have the same autonomy. This bill is not about eye surgery. Eye surgery is a buzz term that is used in the opposition as a scare tactic. We doctors of optometry have been performing minor surgeries since the day I was licensed, at least 25 years ago. So we are trained in depth in such procedures, and they are routine and within our scope of practice. However, I would no more perform an eye surgery that I was not thoroughly qualified and trained to do than would a dentist perform a jaw reconstruction, or a nurse practitioner perform spinal surgery, or a physician perform neurosurgery. But I believe that the world must evolve, and I know that professions advance and change. There is no way to predict what tools or treatment options a doctor of optometry will need 20 years from now to protect or cure the eyes and vision of a patient. This is why House Bill is purposely written with such broad language, to allow for updates as things advance. So if history is an indicator, there will be more treatment options available to us than we can do now. And this bill allows the profession of optometry to evolve, encompassing unforeseeable changes in technology. And I trust the optometry board members to make those changes and oversee those changes.
Thank you. A question from Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, through the chair. As you're talking about CEUs to further the optometry scope of practice, can you give us an example of some of the CEUs that you'd be looking forward to taking that would broaden your scope of practice?
I think that's, excuse me, Representative Sullivan Leonard, through the chair. I would think that, as I said, some of these are unforeseen. In some other states, there are minor surgical procedures that we don't do in the state of Alaska that could be done, that other optometrists do in other states. There are things such as laser procedures that are done in other states that optometrists do. So there is a large range.
Thanks.
Representative Knapp.
So continuing, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So continuing credits, educational credits, what is there's a state mandate and then there's a board mandate. What is that, 16 hours a year or eight, or what kind of continuing, what type of continuing education are you required to do now, and the frequency, is it once a year, 2 years, I
guess? Representative Knopp, through the chair. Right now, optometrists are required to have 18 hours of continuing education every year. Okay. So our licensing periods are 2 years, so it'd be 36 hours. That is in regulation, which is more than the statute says. The statute that we're trying to update has 8 hours. Those are included in the 36.
And to become a licensed optometrist, is it 2 years of school, 4 years of school? What do you have to have just 25 years ago when you started?
We have 4 years of undergraduate education, okay, and then 4 years of optometry school, okay, and then optional residencies that people can do afterwards.
One last follow-up. And when we talk about laser procedures, there are even laser procedures day, and I think some of it's recently changed, that ophthalmologists do that other ophthalmologists aren't necessarily certified to do. I think there's been some recent changes in that as well. Are you familiar with that?
Through the chair, no, I'm not familiar with those, what's in the ophthalmology statute.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bull. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I feel like there's a
I guess it's a definition thing again, but, you know, we have a stack of letters, and if the letter is written from someone with MD after their name, they oppose the bill. If it's written with OD, they support the bill. The MD people are saying there's no training, they're not surgeons, they're not trained to do this procedure. And obviously the bill isn't stating a particular procedure, but I think there's something that people are having in mind. And then most of the ODs are saying, optometrists are saying that, yes, we have the training. So there's a differing of opinion. And at some point, I guess we'll try to get a little more clear definition. But when the board wants to do what's within the scope of training, would that be the continuing ed? Would that count as the training if you're required to have continuing ed every year? So let's say it's a procedure that didn't exist when you went to school and you've been practicing for so many years. And now the procedure's out. You take continuing ed. You get trained. So now you maybe want to do this procedure, and the MD ophthalmologists are saying, no, these people haven't had residencies in surgery. They are not trained surgeons. They can't do the procedure. Well, first of all, does continuing ed count as your sort of basic training? That'd be my first question.
Representative
or training.
Well, through the chair. So I think if I understand your question, for example, if a new procedure, if the board allowed optometrists to do a new procedure, there would be some sort of training that would go along with that. I'm thinking back to examples of when optometrists were allowed to perform injections or maybe different levels of treatment options topically and orally. So what they did is at one point there was like a 100-hour class that every optometrist had to take. At another time, there was, you know, a 7 hours of injection training that an optometrist had to take if they, you know, had not already been trained in school. So, you know, new grads were grandfathered in. That's what I think.
Thank you. And I know you have other people that want to testify. So, has there been another sort of, you just mentioned a couple of examples, and maybe you just answered it, but, and I guess other professions have the same thing. I know dental hygienists, for example, now can give injections of Novocaine in certain states, and that's sort of a stretching of what they did 20 years ago, mm-hmm. That's changing. And maybe this other procedure that seems to be obliquely referred to is another one that's pushing the boundaries. Are there other examples, or I guess you just gave example of injections and mm-hmm. such, where at times that wasn't allowed, and then the board, is that the process that went through allowing it?
Correct, Representative Wohl, through okay. the chair. I think maybe what you're getting at is what we call a standard of care. And so for any given procedure, whether an optometrist performs it or an ophthalmologist performs it or a dentist performs it or an MD performs it, whatever that procedure is, there's a standard, and everybody has to meet that standard. It doesn't matter what, letters they have after their name. They're all going to be held to a high standard in making sure that procedure is done correctly through whatever education route they take to get to it.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Representative Birch. Thank you, Ms. Matheson. We have off-net now. We will go to Scott Lindstrom. Mr. Lindstrom, can you place your name and affiliation on the record and provide your testimony?
Hey, can everybody hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay. My name is Scott Lindstrom, and I want to thank the chairman and members of the committee for your attention and careful consideration of House Bill 103. I'm an ophthalmologist, a medical doctor who specializes in diseases and surgery of the retina and vitreous. I practiced in Anchorage, Alaska for greater than 20 years. I have a little bit of a cough. I'm also president of the Alaska Society of Eye Physicians and Surgeons. I speak to you as a surgeon with over 25 years of experience caring for and performing surgery on patients' eyes. More importantly, I speak to you as a concerned citizen. House Bill 103 and its companion, Senate Bill 36, is opposed by the Alaska Society of Eye Physicians and Surgeons, by the State of Alaska Board of Medical Examiners, Alaska State Medical Association, and the American Academy of Ophthalmology. Why is this legislation so controversial? The first issue with the bill involves the language allowing optometrists unrestricted ability to prescribe all narcotic drugs. Just 3 years ago, your body passed legislation allowing them to prescribe hydrocodone limiting to no more than 4 days of use. Now, a short time later, they need unrestricted ability to prescribe all scheduled drugs. Have you, any of you asked them why they need this authority? I perform hundreds of very complex surgical procedures every year and rarely prescribe narcotics for pain control. Currently, there's an epidemic of overdose deaths related to prescription narcotics throughout the country. Our governor has declared a state of emergency recently. By allowing non-medical doctors disability, you're only contributing to the problem. This in itself should be cause to defeat this legislation. Secondly, House Bill 103 and Senate Bill 36, as written, are the most expansive scope of practice bills in the nation. This legislation would give the optometric board full authority to determine which invasive diagnostic and surgical procedures optometrists may perform on patients' eyes. The optometric board consists of four optometrists and one layperson. There's no medical doctor, no surgeon. Can they make an objective decision? The sponsors of the bill claim the board will be closely scrutinized by the Attorney General. What, may I ask, does the Attorney General know of eye surgery? The state of Washington has a very clear law defining eye surgery. In the law, optometrists are prohibited from performing surgery. We ask that a very clear definition of eye surgery be added to this bill. We understand the optometric profession's desire to govern itself. In the interest of patient safety, this ability to govern should not include unrestricted ability to prescribe narcotics, should not include surgery. Thank you for your attention, and I'll be happy to entertain any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Lindstrom. Any questions? Representative Knopp and then Representative Birch.
Mr. Lindstrom, thanks for the testimony. So two questions for you. In the prescribing of drugs, narcotic drugs you mentioned, does that not fall under part of the continuing education requirements? Do you know that?
I don't know where it falls. It's written in the bill that optometrists will be allowed to have unrestricted ability to prescribe all scheduled drugs. And they currently have the ability to prescribe hydrocodone, which is the strongest pain medication I prescribe. Why they need more, I think, would be a good question for the optometric community. Okay.
So I'll just follow up. So when you talked about putting the definition of surgeries in there, and the bill does have, I mean, it clearly says may not do procedures beyond the scope of the education and experience, and that seems like a real reasonable. So I would think within that would define their authority to do procedures, but I guess I would also think that would mean you couldn't issue drugs of any type unless you were well versed on the effects and that process for doing so, and that's why I was going with that question. You don't feel that verbiage within their education experience is adequate enough in the definition of surgeries then?
No, I don't. I think this is Washington State enacted a definition of surgery many years ago. With this bill, it leaves it wide open for the optometric board to basically define what they can do, what they can't do, as well as what the education requirements are. I think it's very important when you evaluate this bill to look at what's gone on in other states. There are other states, Oklahoma, Louisiana, Kentucky, where optometrists have had bills similar to this pass, and look at what the boards there have done regarding educational requirements and what procedures they're performing.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the question would be, do dentists and nurses have the same latitude in Alaska for prescribing narcotics that ophthalmologists do?
I'm not familiar with what latitude that they have. We have, you know, being a medical doctor, Wisconsin Medical School, internship, residency, and fellowship training, I have the ability to prescribe all scheduled medications. Do I need to prescribe all the scheduled medications? In what I do as a physician, the strongest medication I really prescribe is hydrocodone, and I very rarely go beyond 3 to 4 days postoperatively after a very, you know, intense surgical procedure.
Thank you.
At the point of the narcotic ability to prescribe narcotics to optometrists is when you're the reason that these medications are restricted is that the more prescriptions that are written, the more abuse that will occur out in the general public, and it really is an epidemic throughout the country. So when the FDA, DEA restricted these, they were trying to reduce the number of prescriptions being written.
Thank you.
Representative Justin.
Thank you. Through the chair, Dr. Lindstrom, Dr. Matheson said that there could be a large range of potential surgeries, and I guess that may be of interest. I guess what I'm wondering is, looked at from your profession, if there are if there are 200 types of ophthalmic surgery, are there 25 of them that your cohort believes, with adequate training, short of going to medical school, are acceptable? I mean, and that the law doesn't allow for now. So I guess I'm sort of looking at it from that direction.
I think you probably get a different opinion from you know who you speak to regarding what is acceptable and an acceptable procedure. Can you hear me okay? I'm getting some feedback.
Yes, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. There's certain procedures that optometrists are currently allowed to perform, removing a superficial foreign body, epilation, placing punctal plugs, certain injections around the eye that don't penetrate the eye. Are there more procedures that they are capable of doing with their proper training? I'm sure there are. Is it necessary? And is it safe for the public? And there's, the procedures that I do are very, very, complicated and require often general anesthesia. You need to go to medical school and do a surgical residency to perform these procedures. And the vast majority of procedures that we do require surgical residency and fellowship training. The danger of this bill is that the optometrists that have not had a surgical residency are not medical doctors. Optometric board are making these decisions. There's no medical doctor or surgeon part of the decision process. You've got the optometric board and the attorney general's office. Okay. I have a problem with that.
Thank you.
Follow up. Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you, Dr. Lindstrom. Next, we have Dr. Evan Wolf. Mr. Wolf, can you place your name and affiliation on the record and provide your testimony, please?
Hello, Evan Wolf here. I'm an ophthalmologist in Matsu Valley. Can y'all hear me okay?
If you could speak up a little bit, I think that would help.
Hello,
Wolf yes.
here calling from Matsu Valley. I'm an ophthalmologist.
Very much better, thank you.
So, yeah, I've been practicing here for about 15 years. I always say I had 30 years of training before I started practicing because I started in kindergarten and didn't finish till I was 35. But once I get into practice, it's a fascinating field, and I've worked with tremendous optometrists my whole career so far. But this bill is extremely flawed. As Dr. Lindstrom said, it's the most expansive scope of practice bill in the country by far, in its sort of vague, open-ended wording. I suppose the autonomy of the optometry profession is sort of the main issue with this bill. And, you know, what is their scope of practice and how can it change? Washington's data, as Dr. Lindstrom said, has been very, very clear after years and years of hashing this issue over about how to define, you know, what the scope of practice is for optometry and what is surgery and which procedures are not considered surgical and can be done by an optometrist in the clinic. And so I think looking to, RCW 18
5.53.010, Section 8 is the current law in Washington that makes a lot of sense, and it really sort of puts these issues to rest very clearly and very carefully in a way that protects the public and allows everyone to do their jobs. So I just wanted to point that out. Also, as far as training goes, I think there's a lot of confusion about, you know, what kind of training does it take to do, which kind of procedures. It's a nebulous subject that really has no answer, but if you think about, you know, what training is required to become an ophthalmologist, what kind of training is required to become an optometrist, and why does it matter? Well, I think if you look at, say, Malcolm Gladwell's work where he, you know, he wrote many books about outliers and you know, what it takes to become an expert at anything, he says it takes 10,000 hours to become an expert, whether it's a pianist, a surgeon, whatever it is. I'm sure there's exceptions to that, but I think what you have to realize is that the training is not just academic knowledge. It's also how to develop judgment and then actual surgical skill. And it took me, I calculated 26,000 hours of training to get to the point where I can do lasers and cataract surgery every day safely. Whereas the training for an optometrist would be about 8,000 hours, and it wouldn't be directed at those skills. It would be, as it is now, it's directed at primary care optometry, which is a very necessary part of what happens in healthcare, but it's not relevant to, you know, medical, surgical, laser procedures. So, you know, the thought that optometrists could go back and do continuing education to learn these procedures, even the ones that are existing now, I just don't think is tenable. It's just not safe. It's not realistic to think that that's going to happen. A little bit of proof here. These quotes from Journal of the American Medical Association, Ophthalmology in 2016. That's JAMA, a very well-respected journal. October 2016, Dr. Stein and others wondered what happens in states like Kentucky, Oklahoma, where ophthalmologists and optometrists are both doing really basic laser procedures. What are the outcomes? Does it matter who does the procedure? And I encourage everyone to look at that study. The bottom line was that it's 2.3 times more likely for a procedure to need to be repeated if it were done by an optometrist than if it had been done by an ophthalmologist. And so that's a fairly safe procedure. In the worst case scenario, it had to be repeated. I think we need to be very careful about what realm we get into with non-surgeons performing surgeries, even lasers. So that's basically my comments. Be happy to take questions.
Thank you, Dr. Wolf. Comment or questions, Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. just back to your statement about training. You said you did 26,000 hours of training. Is that before you did sort of unaccompanied surgery on your own?
Let's see. That includes medical school and residency. Yeah, so that was, you know, in residency, it's a staged, you know, four-year process of learning basic surgeries. Whereas in medical school, it was developing the judgment, the clinical knowledge, the vocabulary, the sort of the temperament to be able to do those procedures, but not actually learning them yet.
Follow. Okay, so when you say training, you just mean your overall medical education of 8 years, not specifically eye surgery training.
12,000 hours of medical training, 14,000 hours of ophthalmology training. And in my spare time, I spent 8,000 hours to get a PhD in biology, but that's not relevant. And I can't take that back.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Dr. Christensen, or Dr. Wolf. Next, we have Eric Christensen. Mr. Christensen, can you place your name and affiliation on the record and provide your testimony?
Yes, Eric Christensen, Dr. of Optometry in Ketchikan. Been in Ketchikan for a long time, since 1990. Ketchikan is, we have ophthalmologists who rotate through here periodically, but basically I am the the medically based optometrist in our community. I have a partner who's older than me who is not comfortable with that particular area, and so I am the medical optometrist. And every day, my ophthalmologists are incredibly well trained, and they are the persons who should be doing surgery. But this, as I look at this bill, it really is not talking about surgery. It's really talking about allowing optometrists to be able to practice to a level commensurate with their training. And I'm not going to jump on board and start doing surgeries because I'm not trained to do a surgery currently, to do surgeries currently. I do every day a number of minor procedures, and many of the procedures we're talking about are that optometrists will be doing currently are relatively minor in scope. And in fact, if we weren't doing them, health aides and physicians in communities would be doing them, like lancing, styes, which are kind of a boil on the eye, removing skin tags from eyelids and stuff. And the patients are doing this stuff on their own. So why not have somebody more trained, well, much better trained than those persons out in the local villages or in the local clinic doing that? Also, a lot of it's about making decisions, and I'm making decisions about people's eye health every day, and I refer many patients to multiple types of doctors to maximize the care that they receive. And all we're asking here in this particular bill is that we modernize the optometry statute so that we can, as time goes on, be able to do things that are within our training. I would like to be able to hire a young optometrist to come and help me out here. And young optometrists are well trained. They're trained in many of these procedures, and it would be a wonderful thing for our community to have that kind of person here. I've been working on and we've had some limited success with getting ophthalmology to rotate through Ketchikan and do certain procedures. We have a cataract surgeon who may be coming soon, but it's difficult for them to travel from somewhere else and come and go. And we're also looking and talking with a retinal subspecialty group in Seattle to try and get their help here, because those are things that I'm not even going to attempt to do. We're not talking about going in and doing retinal surgery or cataract surgery here. We're just letting the board, who know what the practice of optometry is, and in discussion with other boards to develop the practice of optometry moving forward so it's modernized.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. Any questions? Next we have Matthew Guess. Mr. Guess, if you can place your name and affiliation on the record and provide your testimony, please.
Yeah, hi. My name is Matthew Guess, and I'm an ophthalmologist practicing in Anchorage, Alaska since 2009. I'm calling in opposition to House Bill 103. The bill before you is framed to allow the Board of Optometry to self-regulate their scope of practice. My concern as an ophthalmologist and why I oppose this bill is that it will ultimately allow expansion of the scope of practice to include invasive procedures in and around the eye for which they have received no meaningful formal training to perform. I think I heard earlier in the testimony that Dr. Matheson reported that part of their continuing education required 7 hours of injection training for eyelid procedures. In my experience, I personally spent time in medical school, residency, and 2 extra years of training and a fellowship and an accredited retina fellowship to learn to both diagnose and treat diseases of the eye with office procedures and operating room-based surgeries. During my 2 years of fellowship, I worked 55 to 65 hours per week and examined tens of thousands of patients and performed thousands of surgeries under the guidance of experienced mentors. There's no substitute for this training. It allows me to diagnose and provide treatment through both procedures and surgeries in the safest manner both possible for the patient. And I don't believe, 7 hours of training a year, that was, to me sounds like a minimal amount of work
for education to learn new procedures or stay current in the procedures that are available. I think this is one example of, you know, when we talk about educational training, what is meaningful is the question, and what is useful that actually provide safe care to the citizens of Alaska. House Bill 103, as it is currently written, will allow the Board of Optometry to circumvent my training and similar training that my colleagues in ophthalmology have completed by ultimately giving non-surgeons, the optometrist, the ability to perform procedures and surgeries, which is a detriment to the citizens of the state of Alaska. Thank you for your time, and I welcome any questions you have for me.
Thank you, Mr. Guest. So we are at 5 o'clock now, and I intend to go a few more minutes. We have 7 more individuals signed up to testify. We'll see how far we can get and then continue public testimony at a future meeting. So next up, I have Kelly Lorenz. Do you have testimony for us this afternoon?
Yes.
And can you place your name and affiliation? Yes, we can hear you. Can you place your name and affiliation on the record, please?
Great, yes. My name is Dr. Kelly Lorenz, and I am a surgically trained board-certified ophthalmologist and glaucoma specialist in Anchorage, Alaska. And I'm calling to ask you to oppose House Bill 103. The vague wording of House Bill 103 opens the door for optometrists to perform procedures for which they are not adequately trained. These would include several types of laser procedures, eyelid surgery, including eyelid lifts, limbal relaxing incisions, pterygium surgeries, among others. A couple weekend courses at a local hotel by an optometrist will not make up for years of surgical training by an ophthalmologist, and the people of Alaska deserve better. This bill would effectively lower the standards of surgical care in Alaska. Who would you send your mother to for eye surgery or a laser procedure? Per the National Consumers League, 90% of people polled stated they would rather have an MD when it comes to surgery. There is just no public outcry for this bill. Would you choose an ophthalmologist for a family member, but an optometrist for someone you don't know that doesn't know any better? Is that fair to the people of our state? Don't they deserve better? Someone needs to look out for the public's best interest. All procedures we perform are technically involved and require a great deal of training, skill, and practice. There are no, quote, routine procedures. All lasers used in the eye cut as sharply as a knife. The lasers we perform in clinic are not diagnostic in nature, and there are risks, significant risks, of adverse events, including permanent blindness. Further, there is no place for the use of lasers to perform peripheral iridotomies in rural Alaska. If a patient develops acute angle closure glaucoma, this is treated medically first with drops, pills, and IV medications. The patient is flown to Anchorage because if these do not work in the acute setting, the answer is surgery and not to attempt a laser through an edematous cloudy cornea with a patient in active angle closure. And because of the potential for complications, a preventive peripheral iridotomy is best performed near an equipped operating room. By the time the patient travels from a village, they may have already lost a significant portion of their vision. Now, if not much of that made sense to you, or if this is new information, you must vote in opposition to House Bill 103. These issues need to be understood in full. And by the way, a fish hook to the eye requires an equipped operating room and a surgically trained ophthalmologist. There is a reason why medicine organizes itself into cardiologists and cardiovascular surgeons, neurologists and neurosurgeons, etc. There's a reason you want a surgeon to do surgery. They do it a lot, and they do it well, and they manage the inevitable complications. So please keep Alaska's high standards for medical and surgical care by opposing House Bill 103. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Lorenz. Next, we have Steve Dobson. Mr. Dobson, can you place your name and affiliation on the record and provide your testimony, please?
Hello, I'm Steve Dobson, Chairman Keto, members of the House, Labor and Commerce Committee. I'm an optometrist, been in private practice here in Anchorage for over 30 years, and I am in favor of and respectfully request your support of HB 103. Where do we start? You know, I can, I haven't answered all of those questions that I've heard from the ophthalmologist that have recently testified, and there's a lot of intent to, I think, mislead. For example, or maybe they misunderstand the intent of our legislation. First of all, House Bill 103 is is not about surgery. For some reason, organized ophthalmology has turned this into a surgical bill. It's about board autonomy, and it's about practicing optometry at the highest level that optometrists are trained and licensed to do. In those states that have, as Dr. Lindstrom pointed out, more expanded authority than we have here in Alaska, if you really want to get right down to risk, the insurance companies understand risk. And in fact, the malpractice insurance is the same in those states where they do these minor procedures, minor laser procedures. It's the same malpractice as here in Alaska. It's less than $500 a year. If anybody understands risk, it's those folks. So that's one way to cut through the chase. In other words, obviously optometrists are doing what they're trained to do and nothing more. Optometrists, the education, I'm not sure why the ophthalmologists were always comparing their advanced subspecialty education to optometry. Optometrists are trained in very few of the procedures that ophthalmologists do. I think we all agree with that. And that's not what we're trying to do. That's absolutely not what this legislation is about. The clinical education of the optometrist does not have to parallel that of the ophthalmologist any more than the education of a family physician needs to parallel a neurosurgeon or a heart surgeon. Ophthalmologists are vitally needed. Patients need their advanced expertise for cataract surgery, retina surgery, severe trauma. That's why they have all this training. That is not optometry, and it's absolutely not the intent of the legislation. The ophthalmologists know that. I'm not sure why they're putting up this surgical issue. It's not a surgery bill. Matter of fact, this bill doesn't authorize optometrists to do anything. It's all about board autonomy, just like the nurse practitioners have and the dentists have. So the dentists can they be trusted to run their board and protect the public? Can the advanced nurse practitioners be trusted to manage their board and protect the public? We believe it's time for optometry. We believe they deserve the respect and consideration. They've demonstrated that over the last 30 years. And at every, for over the past 30 years, where optometry has had to come to the legislature to try to gain privileges to reflect their current level of training and education, we've met with the same ophthalmology opposition with the same comments that you've heard today. If you want to be provide medical care, you should have gone to medical school. Well, dentists haven't done that. The nurse practitioners didn't do that. And I would venture to say that going back the last 30 years, what we've had to fight for and delay getting that care available to the public, I would venture to say there's no ophthalmologist that's testified today that would take back any of that, even though when we were trying to get this legislation passed, the all branches of ophthalmology vehemently opposed any of optometric or recognizing any of the advances in optometric care. So with that, I know we're almost out of time and out of respect for the committee. I'd be happy to answer any of the questions that were proposed or concerns by any of the speakers that you've heard today.
Thank you, Mr. Dobson, and we've actually lost most of the committee to another meeting or other meetings. So what we are going to have to do, we have one, two, three, four, five individuals that have still yet not had a time chance to testify. We will leave public testimony open, and we will bring the bill back before us. But at this time, and I think in addition to bills previously heard on Wednesday, we've got a few more appointments to boards and commissions. House Bill 142, Unemployment Compensation Benefits, and House Bill 126, Organized Militia Workers' Compensation, and we will make sure that this bill is adequately noticed for a future meeting. We'll continue public testimony and get on to amendments and committee discussion. With that, at 5:09, we're going to adjourn House Labor and Commerce for March 27th. Thank you.